In the period that we are discussing, a prominent anti-Zionist Jew was moving up the political ladder on his way to achieving a position to stop Zionist aspirations. Yet family, and I believe providence, would intervene. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 169, England and the Holy Land. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. In the Negev Desert, in Steh Boker, one will find the grave of David Ben-Gurion. His gravestone makes no mention of his accomplishments. The words Prime Minister are nowhere to be seen. Aside from the dates of his birth and death, one sees only one stark statement. Quote, immigrated to Palestine in 1906, end quote. The settlement of the land of Israel and by implication the establishment of Jewish sovereignty over it. This for Ben-Gurion was an embodiment of his life and legacy, and he chose to cite his arrival in the Holy Land in 1906 as the moment when the events leading to his accomplishments began. And there is a historical point to be made in this context. When David Gruen left his hometown in Eastern Europe and changed his name and life in the first decade of the 20th century, few would have predicted the role he would play in the next decades in the story of Israel and Jerusalem. And upon reflection, we realize that this is true of various Jewish figures around the world. As we consider the years of 1906 to 1913 as part of the Zionist story, we need to see the historical stage being set for what is yet to come. At the time, few would have guessed that England would have the authority soon after to determine the future of the Holy Land. But in the end, it would be those in England in the period leading up to the First World War that would prove profoundly critical to the next stage of the Zionist story. In describing the various Jewish figures in England that will figure in our tale over the next several episodes, I will be drawing primarily on two very different works, Chaim Berman's book The Cousinhood about Britain's Jewish elite, and Jonathan Schneer's History of the Balfour Declaration. I also am drawing on fascinating facts about this larger story from Norman LeBrecht's recent book, Genius and Anxiety. Today, we will only describe the connections between some of these Jews in England, setting the stage for our discussion in the days to come. Our story begins in the generation before World War I, with a Jewish family by the name of Samuel living in Liverpool, central members of the lay leadership of the Orthodox community. One member of this family, whose name was Montague Samuel, decided to legally reverse his name and become Samuel Montague. He moved to London and with his brother, Edwin Samuel, went into banking and achieved enormous success. One might think that in reversing his name and taking on the last name Montague, Samuel Montague was seeking to assimilate, but nothing could be further from the truth. This Samuel Montague would indeed achieve extraordinary social success. He would become a member of Parliament and ultimately raised to the peerage known as Baron Swathling. But what was most striking of all about this man was his fierce dedication to Judaism, a Jewish identity that never wavered. His daughter's description of him deserves to be quoted. Quote, the religion of Samuel Montague affected his whole conception of life. He was a Jew primarily, a citizen, a politician, a businessman long afterwards. It was with Jewish eyes that he judged men and things. His religion was to him a source of discipline, and he never got outside this discipline for a single instant. He believed in God with the intensity of an intense nature, and his God was a lawgiver whose laws were worthy of the closest attention and most complete allegiance. Obedience and the self-sacrifice which it involved led him to holiness. He never chafed under the discipline. He literally loved to obey the smallest enactment, and this obedience was the form of communion by which tradition told him God was to be reached. End quote. Thus we have this description from his daughter of this incredibly unusual figure, Baron Swathling, a wealthy member of the House of Lords, a member of Britain's Liberal Party, who constantly sponsored legislation to help the poor, a massive philanthropist to both Jewish and non-Jewish causes, and a staunch Orthodox Jew. And though he never became a formal active member of the Zionist movement, Samuel Montague, Baron Swathling, was very positively disposed toward it. We know this because of a fascinating description by Theodore Herzl in his diary. Herzl, visiting England, had gone to see Montague before Montague was a lord, when he was still Sir Samuel Montague. Listen to this incredible scene described by Herzl. Quote, lunched at the home of Sir Samuel Montague, MP, a house of English elegance in grand style. Sir Samuel, a splendid old fellow, the best Jew I have ever met so far. At table, he presides over his family, which for the rest is unamiable, or perhaps merely well-bred, with the air of a good-natured patriarch. Kosher food served by three liveried footmen. After lunch, in the making room, I expounded my case. I gradually roused him. end quote. Swaythling, or as he was known then, Sir Samuel Montague, according to Herzl's diary, professed incredible enthusiasm to Herzl for the Zionist project. Yet, Samuel Montague's son, Edwin Montague, would live in utter rebellion of all his father stood for, even as he would parallel his father's political success. It is to this man that we now turn. Edwin Montague, born 1879, was raised in the orthodoxy of his parents. Following his early education, he went to Cambridge. Until then, he had been forced to keep kosher, and he wrote home, upon reaching university, that while he would always see himself as a Jew, at the same time, he would not be continuing his father's observance. He wrote to his father that, quote, my definition of a good Jew differing from yours, end quote. Edwin Montague would emphasize in his life that he did not believe that the Jews were a people. As such, Edwin Montague, the younger Montague, hated Zionism with a fierce hatred. To a non-Jewish supporter of Zionism, and I'm drawing here, as in so much of this presentation on Berman's book, Montague once said, quote, my whole life I have been trying to get back to the ghetto. You want to force me back there, end quote. Chaim Berman further writes that as the Zionist movement gathered strength, for the younger Montague it was, quote, as if his bearded father and all his fathers before him were rising to torment him. His struggle against Zionism was no mere contention with a political philosophy. It was part of a personal exorcism, end quote. And this was a problem for the Zionist movement because the younger Edwin Montague, fierce foe of Zionism, embarked on a political career that would take him straight up, in Disraeli's phrase, the greasy pole of political leadership. Elected to Parliament in 1906, he became friends with the then Minister of the Exchequer, a man that will be very important for our story in the episodes to come, Herbert Asquith. And as Asquith succeeded, Edwin Montague with him succeeded as well. Thus, in the period that we are discussing, a prominent anti-Zionist Jew was moving up the political ladder, on his way to achieving a position to stop Zionist aspirations. Yet family, and I believe providence, would intervene. Edwin Montague would have a foil, and that foil, incredibly, would be his first cousin, a man that will also appear more than once in our story. Herbert Samuel, born to Baron Swaythling's brother Edwin, would lose his father as a young man, and Baron Swaythling, his uncle, became Herbert Samuel's guardian. Herbert Samuel also entered Parliament a year before his cousin Edwin Montague in 1896, and he too would ultimately rise to a cabinet position. So that by the beginning of World War I, there were two Jewish members of the cabinet, first cousins, Edwin Montague and Herbert Samuel, both of them raised by Samuel Montague, the Baron Swaythling. Unlike Edwin Montague, Herbert Samuel embraced Zionism, or, as a biographer of Samuel's put it, quote, Zionism was the one political passion of a singularly passionless career, end quote. Where did the Zionism come from? The answer, I think, must begin with his guardian, the proud Jew that was Baron Swaythling. But there's also another answer, and here we turn to one of the most brilliant and complicated Jewish figures in England, the Chacham of the Spanish and Portuguese Jewish community, Moses Gaster, a Romanian Jew who spoke 10 languages and who led the English Zionist Federation. Chacham Gaster's home, near the Lauderdale Road Synagogue, at 193 Maida Vale, would become the place of many meetings. And as we will see, it would be there that the beginnings of the Balfour Declaration would be born. Through his wife, with whom he had 10 children, Gaster had gotten to know Herbert Samuel. As the historian Jonathan Schneer tells us, quote, the link came via Samuel's wife, one of whose childhood friends had gone on to marry the Chacham of England's Sephardic Jews. The wives remained close, and as a result, the two couples socialized on occasion. At least once, Gaster sought a political favor from Samuel, asking him to help obtain naturalization papers for a Russian emigre, none other than Chaim Weizmann. Samuel obliged, end quote. Thus, another figure critical to our story enters the picture in England, Chaim Weizmann. Jonathan Schneer further tells us of Herbert Samuel that, quote, naturally enough, when sometime later he became acquainted with Zionist ideas, he looked to Gaster for reading material. I remember Dr. Gaster being associated from time to time with my early inquiries into the Zionist movement, Samuel later recalled, end quote. And Schneer further adds that, quote, when Britain entered the war in 1913, Samuel, on his own, began to present the concept of a Jewish state to other members of the government. First, he met the Foreign Secretary, Sir Edward Grey, at the beautiful Foreign Office building and said very directly to him, perhaps the opportunity might arise for the fulfillment of the ancient aspiration of the Jewish people and the restoration of the Jewish state, end quote. All this then set the stage for the intersection of the life of Herbert Samuel with that of the man that he had helped bring to England, Chaim Weizmann, a brilliant chemist who took up residency in Manchester, who had risen to leadership within the World Zionist Movement. Thus, these figures and themes. Cousin versus cousin, Herbert Samuel versus Edwin Montague, Herbert Samuel's relationship with Gaster, Herbert Samuel's relationship with Weitzman. All these subjects will appear at the heart of the Zionist story, and we will meet Lloyd George, Balfour, Herbert Asquith, and others. Of course, outside England, there are appearing on the scenes other figures whose major time is about to come. There is, as we mentioned, Ben-Gurion. Vladimir Jabotinsky at this moment is a Zionist journalist. Menachem Begin will be born in 1913. And there is an American whose journey from the years 1905 to 1917 will be fascinating. Louis Dembitz Brandeis. All this is yet to be told. For now, the stage is set. And the wondrous story of the battle over the Balfour Declaration is yet to come. This is Mayor Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow. Signing off.